So my talk tonight is going to center around a story from the Gospels that probably most of you are familiar with. It's the Transfiguration. It's when Jesus takes three of his disciples up on a mountain. I'm not going to read it at first. I'm just going to go through line by line with a commentary. But as I like to say, these stories are not just about Jesus. They're not just about his disciples. Same thing when we get into the Bhagavad Gita. It's not about Krishna exclusively or Arjuna. It's really a story about us. And in the microcosm of this story of the Transfiguration, we get the macrocosm. We get the picture of the spiritual life. It's really contained in this story. So again, it's a story about you, it's a story about me, and it's a story about our spiritual journey. So, it begins with Jesus took Peter, James, and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. So, I could do a whole retreat on each one of these lines, so I promise to be succinct. What's clear, it's implicit, but I want to make it obvious and reflect on it for a moment. Jesus is the guru. Jesus is the teacher. He is the embodiment of the divine in this story. And Peter, James, and John are his disciples. All right, so you may be saying, yes, that's obvious. But I want us to sort of wrestle with the depth of this. What would make James, Peter, and John want to be Jesus' disciple? What would make you want to be Yogananda's disciple or whomever guru it is that you follow? Let me paraphrase what Yogananda said when he met his guru, Sri Yukteswar. It begins to give us a glimpse into the answer. When he met him, he said, "Oh, those were the eyes I have dreamed of many times and I have seen in my silence and in my meditation." And he said he was drawn to Sri Yukteswar like this powerful magnetic pull. And then when they met and they talked, the first thing they did was exchange unconditional love with each other. So you've heard me say this before, the guru-disciple relationship is absolutely essential if we are really going to evolve in our spiritual lives. And I think there's three things that we experience when we meet the guru. And again, they don't have to be with us physically. They need to be with us in our spirits and in our hearts. But there's three things that we experience. First of all, there's a wholeness and a completeness that we catch, that we feel. Every time I've been in a really sacred place, like Assisi, Italy, or Yogananda's places in California, or Roy Davis Jr.'s place in Atlanta or outside of Atlanta in Georgia, whenever I'm there, there's just a kind of wholeness. For the moment, I feel complete and whole. I'm tapped into something that is bigger than me that brings about this experience of completeness and wholeness. The second thing that we experience is what the disciples experienced with Jesus. They experience an integration. Let me say how important that is. How much of our time, our energy, our imagination, our emotions, our intellect, our will, our passions, they're just dispersed over many different things that draw our attention. The opposite of samadhi, union, is attention deficit disorder. Spirituality is the ultimate cure for attention deficit disorder. Because when you're in the presence of the guru, and again, you don't have to be in their physical presence. When you are touching them in your spirit, in your heart, part of what you experience is an integration of all of your humanity. It gets more and more focused on what is ultimately important. We become less and less scattered and more integrated, and it's always a positive experience. That's what the disciples experienced. Lastly, what they experienced was a kind of radiance, a beauty that filled their spirits, that touched them in their souls. In that radiance, there's a transmission of grace and energy. And I don't mean this in a superficial way. If you haven't fallen in love with a guru, then you don't have a guru. The whole foundation of the relationship with the guru is one of love. When I say falling in love, I don't mean that again at a superficial, sentimental level. You've heard me say this before. First time I read the autobiography, a fellow psychotherapist, a colleague, gave it to me. I read it. And I have to say, I fell in love with Yogananda. I felt everything that I'm saying, the wholeness, the integration, the radiance. I would sleep with the autobiography in my bed at first. And that's necessary. Otherwise, we're not really going to follow the guru. We'll pick and choose what we want. We'll have infatuations, one-night stands, and all of that. But we're not really going to follow the guru. But once you love, just on a human level, once you really love somebody, your life becomes integrated in their life. Well, that's what happens with the guru. Our life becomes integrated with their life. And it really becomes one life. And we follow them. And that's important because part of the line is that Jesus took them up a mountain. The guru accepts us right where we are, but then takes us where we need to be. And where we might not otherwise go if the guru wasn't leading us. The guru always takes us for a ride, whether we want that ride or not, whether it's pleasant initially or not. But we'll only follow the guru because we have that love, that trust. We have experienced that radiance. And so we say yes. We follow the guru. Now, just again, get the simple symbolism in this. They're not in an elevated state of consciousness. They're in the valley. What does the guru want to do? Take us up the mountain. In biblical symbolism, the mountain, the higher up you go in the mountain, the closer you are to God. That's where Moses got the Ten Commandments, for example. So the guru, we fall in love with the guru, and the guru begins to say, follow me out of your egoic consciousness, out of your fears, out of your addictions. Follow me up the mountain. Now, here's the kicker. You ever done any mountain climbing? It ain't easy. You have to travel really light to climb a mountain. Can't take your computer with you. You can take your cell phone, but there's no coverage up there. So it's of no use to you. You have to let go of the things that are weighing you down and keeping you in egoic consciousness. That's the journey up the mountain. And sometimes it's hard. It's arduous. It's difficult. But we have to let go again of those things that drag us down. It's like we let go of a lesser good for a greater good, a higher good, a transcendental good. There's a sweet story with Yogananda. And this was actually before he met his guru. He went to live in a hermitage, another hermitage with another teacher for a while. And before he left home, now his mother died when he was about 12 and he's about 18 now. And he really kind of took over a role in his family. He really loved his three younger siblings and he helped his father take care of them. And so the night before he left, he said he spent hours crying, sobbing. Is it okay to leave, to follow what my soul is telling me? And what made it even more difficult, his father asked him not to go. But in that prayer and in that wrestling with the angel of God, so to speak, it became clear that he had to go. So the next morning he had that strength and he had that resolve and he said goodbye to his father. I will be back, but I have to do what my soul's calling me to do. That's the trek up the mountain. So then they get to the top of the mountain. And it says that Jesus' clothes, his whole countenance, became whiter than white, brilliant, radiant. See, when we trust the guru, we follow the teacher's teachings, they take us up the mountain. We get purified. We get emptied. And then we're open. What does the radiance represent, the light? It represented a transmission of grace. It represented that transmission of light and love. And that light and love warms the heart, it strengthens the will, inspires the imagination, and brings brilliant clarity to the mind. And we begin to see and we begin to understand. It doesn't stop there, though. See, that light opened their chakras and opened their third eye. And all of a sudden, they looked around, and there was Elijah and Moses. Two of the foremost prophets within the Jewish tradition. They were there the whole time. It was only when they got that transmission of light that their third eye was open and they could see. So the more we follow the guru, the more we're open to the guru's blessing, we develop our third eye. We develop these intuitions. And we begin to know what they know, that we are always surrounded by a communion of saints. We are surrounded by helpers from the unseen realm. And they really become a part of our day-to-day lives. That's what the guru gives us. But there's a symbolism in Elijah and Moses for the disciples and for us. Now, what I'm going to say may sound a little bit controversial, but here's my whole thought. It's not. The goal of spirituality is not merely liberation. I'm going to repeat that. It's not merely liberation. That's half of it. If we stop there, it's not really liberation. There's a teaching within Buddhism where nobody is liberated until everybody is liberated. So the second half of what liberation really means, it's not that we just float into the ether and bliss out on God for the rest of eternity. It actually gets boring after a while, okay? We then give that liberation to others. So let me just say what Elijah and Moses represent in that context. Let's start with Elijah. If you don't know the story of Elijah, he was a great prophet in the Jewish scriptures. And at one point, he's led to go up a mountain, and he's in a cave in the mountain, again, up in a higher state of consciousness. And he hears the voice of God, but it's very interesting. He doesn't hear the voice of God in the thunder, in the storm, in the earthquake, or the fire. And in Western spirituality, that's a leap in evolution, because until then, God's voice was coextensive with nature. God and nature were one. This is a leap in, and again, the spiritual evolution of the West. That God is not nature, God is in nature, but God is not nature. Where is God found? Elijah heard God speak in the whisper, in the stillness, in the silence. The guru takes us into that silence so that we can begin to hear God's whispering in our own hearts and souls. That's Elijah. What does Moses represent? Well, just think of the life of Moses. The second half of his life was spent in complete service to his people. They weren't called the Jews then, they were called the Hebrews, to the Hebrews. Leading them out of servitude, slavery, leading them through the desert, leading them to the promised land. So it goes back to what I was saying a few minutes ago. The goal in spiritual life is not just to be liberated. That's pretty selfish. The goal is to be liberated so you can liberate others. Peter, James, and John were being given their mission in the presence of Elijah and Moses. Go into that silence, hear the voice of God, live from that stillness and that silence, and then be a Moses in your own life. In whatever circumstances God calls you to be Moses. Now, I'm about to say is not going to tickle your ears a whole lot. It ain't easy being Moses. In fact, Moses didn't even make it into the Promised Land. It's a whole nother story another time. It wasn't easy being James and John and Peter. Peter and James were both martyred because they loved the Master. And John was imprisoned in an island outside of Turkey until he died. Love calls us to do whatever it takes. You know, we say that God is love and God is love. And nothing is more blissful than love, and nothing is more demanding than love. Love demands everything. It's easy to keep the rules and the laws, relatively. Love requires everything. That's what Moses and Elijah represented to these intimate disciples of Jesus. And then we hear God speaks and said, "Behold, this is my beloved son. Listen to him." I won't spend a lot of time on that, but particularly for our culture today, we are becoming increasingly secular. Materialism, that limited scientific understanding of reality, that the only thing that is real is what we can measure empirically. And life has become very flat. There is no God. There is no ultimate structure to reality. We get to make up the rules as we want as we go along. At some point in our spiritual life, we have to realize there is something greater than us. It's absolute love, truth, and beauty, and yet it's greater than us. And at some point, we have to, out of love, not out of servitude, not out of fear, out of love and freedom, bow to that which is greater than us. And then the paradox is, when we bow to that is greater than us, that elevates us and it makes us greater. That's the paradox. And the last piece is, they want to stay up on the mountain. They want to build booths. They want to make it their permanent residence. You know, they just want to stay in the glory. And Jesus says, no, 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 no. We got to go back down in the valley to bring this illumination into the valley. Think of Sri Yukteswar, Yogananda's guru. He died in the highest state of consciousness. And what does Yogananda say he was doing in the afterlife? He was working on a higher astral heavenly plane, being a savior there. 1 foot in the bliss and the beatific vision, and 1 foot doing the work of love throughout all eternity. That's liberation. So the goal, not to stay up on the mountain, create the mountain within us, but then to make everything we do an altar. Our work, our play, our relationships, our wives, our husbands, our co-workers, people we meet, the service we're called to do, it's all meant to be an altar of God's presence. And I'll close, of course, with the story of Francis. And some of you have heard this before. Francis was a good preacher, and his friars, his followers, they always wanted to preach too. They were always anxious to preach, and everybody wants to be in the limelight. So Francis told one of the young friars who couldn't wait to preach, he says, "Come on, we're going to go preach. Both of us are going to go preach today." So he was eager, filled with vim and vigor to go preaching. And so the first thing they did was he begged for some food and brought the food to the poor people. Second thing they did was they washed the wounds of some lepers. Third thing they did was console people that were troubled. And by that, it was the end of the day, it was dark, and they were going home. And they said to Francis, "You said I was going to preach, we were going to preach." And Francis said, "We did preach. Not with our words, with our love. That's how we make our lives an altar. Everything becomes a sacrifice. Everything becomes sacred. Everything becomes an opportunity to be a bridge between heaven and earth." That's liberation. The divine in me bows before the divine in each one of you.